Hey, this is Nicole Luciani-Elliott, and you're listening to Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching here at Stanford University. Our first season revolves around how we adapt to the current moment, not simply to make it through, but to reimagine what education looks like, build community, and continue to advance our values, even under circumstances that are far from ideal. In today's episode, Culturally Sustaining Pedagogy, we talk with Daniel Russell, Felicia Homburger, Madison Payton, and Dr. Mike Metz about what it means to be culturally and linguistically sustaining of our students and how that looks in a classroom. If you'd like to join the conversation on Twitter, we'd love to have you be a part of it. You can follow the conversation using hashtag T2MTM. Enjoy the show.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 4 of Teaching to Meet the Moment from the Center to Support Excellence in Teaching at Stanford University's Graduate School of Education. I'm Mike Hines.
And I'm Nicole Luciani-Elliott.
And in today's episode, we're talking to a panel about culturally sustaining pedagogies in our classrooms. Now, Nicole, I know that this is an issue that's something that's really informed your work, both as a classroom teacher and now as a teacher educator. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, where did that conviction come from for you? Was there a experience or a set of experiences that made you say, you know, I really need to dedicate myself to learning more about this and to implementing it in my own teaching?
For sure. I mean, I think it goes back to the fact that I wanted to be a teacher since I was in the second grade. And year after year, the only thing that changed for me was that every time I had some sort of special teacher, I wanted to teach that grade instead. So I started wanting to teach second, and then I wanted to teach fourth because I had these extraordinary teachers in fourth grade, and it went on. And I guess it's no wonder that I ended up teaching mostly 12th graders for 20 years at the high school, actually where I went to high school. I don't come from a traditional college going family. I was the first in my family to go to college. And, the reason for that largely was because of the teachers who I had in high school who changed the trajectory of my life. So I taught for 20 years, and about halfway through those two decades, I encountered a training with a man who has become my mentor, Dr. Shiraki Holly. And in that experience, I came away with language and tools for something that I'd been grappling with the whole time I'd ever been teaching, really. And that's the fact that there was always a predictable and a pervasive gap in my ability to serve kids. I really started to recognize the lack of understanding I had. I think as a white woman teaching an institution that was built for white people, there was a lot that I considered normal, and actually was heavily, heavily, heavily cultural. And the disconnects I was having with students were really because I didn't have the language or understanding that I needed. And I needed to step up in all sorts of ways in getting to know my students beyond what I thought I knew about them. So in those kind of second half of my teaching career, those 10 years, nothing makes me more angry about teaching than opening access and saying all the right words, but not changing our practice and not changing our minds about some things. For example, in many schools across the country, AP is now open to all, but AP teachers haven't necessarily changed the way they teach. And so we're setting kids up. And I think, along with false hope, the only thing that makes me more angry than false hope is really setting our kids up for an experience that will not serve them and that often actually could do harm. So the last 7 years, I've been doing a lot of professional learning and instructional coaching with teachers around the country for how to shift what does it mean to sustain the cultural and linguistic assets of our kids? Like we talked about last week, there's lots of nuances around the concept of culturally sustaining work, culturally responsive, culturally relevant. All of these concepts are really nuanced and different in their own ways. And I make no claim as an expert. I just make the claim that I've been practicing for now almost 2 decades as a teacher and a teacher educator about what it means to really sustain my kids, our kids, as whole humans, and leverage the gifts that they bring in my classroom instruction so that they can show up whole. And so I can show up whole and we can learn to be global citizens together. That's kind of where I come from this whole thing. I'm wondering, you know, you're a professor at one of the premier universities in the country. Where do you fall in all of this? Where have you experienced this and how do you practice it in your own work?
I think, you know, my sort of journey to this work or my introduction to this work is a little bit different. I think, you know, preparing for today's episode, I felt like, man, I don't really have a good story to tell about how I arrived at this place. It's always felt sort of natural, which is not to say at all that, you know, I'm not constantly learning and growing, but just that the foundations of the sort of approach to learning have always seemed pretty present to me. And then, you know, thinking of it in those terms, it really sort of hit me that that's a result of really purposeful actions, specifically by my mother and by my foremothers, who are all educators in some capacity or another, right? So from the outset, I think my mom really approached education in my home with the mind of a pedagogue, right? So we had, you know, I was constantly surrounded by culturally affirming books at home. I mean, I loved King Arthur. Like, don't get me wrong. I loved King Arthur. I loved St. George and the Dragon, but I was reading those things right next to Jumbo Means Hello and Bringing the Rain to Kapiti Plain and Follow the Drinking Gourd. And, you know, I'm about to become a father myself. So I'm like running to the bookstore trying to like find old copies of And the People Could Fly. And I think what happened was, and I think this happens to a lot of us, that approach seemed natural at home, but it didn't quite translate to school, right? So very early in my schooling, I was almost put into a lower class for reading, which was a decision and a label that would have had consequences for the entirety of my sort of K-12 experience, right? And it was because teachers said that I couldn't read. And my mom, thankfully, knew how to navigate those systems being a teacher, right? And she basically came in and told them, you know, he can read just fine, right? The issue isn't, you know, isn't his reading. The issue is that he doesn't want to read the stuff you're putting in front of him, right? And he doesn't particularly feel that he needs to prove anything to you. So you'd better find a way to interest and engage, right? And I think that that attitude is something that I've really tried to take into the classroom with me. And I think it's one that's fundamental to the conversation that we're going to have with these panelists today, right? What can we do to engage our students fully, like you were saying, so that they can bring all of themselves into the classroom and they can show us that sort of full capacity that they have? So I think it's probably time to introduce this panel.
Yeah, I'm sitting with this idea of, would we be talking with Dr. Mike Hines had your mom not known how to navigate that system? That's a really profound thing to consider. I was reading about our poet Amanda, you know, everybody's poet Amanda. Now we claim her as our own American poet laureate. How many Amandas are sitting in classrooms across the country who will never get to be that Amanda because we don't sustain our kids in the way that we should? So with that, let us introduce our panel. The first person I'd like to introduce is named Felicia Humberger. She's a secondary ELA teacher with 25 years of experience. She's a lead coach and consultant for the Center for Culturally Responsive Teaching and Learning. As a practitioner, she's been working on how to be culturally and linguistically responsive with high school students in her own online classroom. And she's developed a training on this through the center that she has led with educators across the country. So I'm hoping she'll give us some good tips today. Welcome to Felicia.
Thanks, Nicole.
Next is Dr. Mike Metz. Dr. Mike Metz is an old friend of CSET. I have to let you all know. He did his doctoral work at Stanford and worked with us. We had the great fortune to work with Dr. Metz. He's now an assistant professor of English education and language and literacies for social transformation at the University of Missouri. A national board certified teacher, Mike has taught in public, private, and charter schools over the last 25 years. His research examines teaching practices that support students in culturally and linguistically complex classrooms. He promotes critical language awareness and a critical inquiry stance toward language study. Welcome, Mike Metz.
Thanks, Nicole. Very happy to be here. Great to see you and glad to be part of the conversation.
We're so glad you're here. Madison Payton is next up on our panel. Madison, serendipitously enough, was actually coached by Mike Metz. So hopefully they'll get a chance to engage in some looking back as we talk today. Madison is an educator, school leader, advocate, and researcher. He's the product of New York City public schools and has spent a decade working with young men of color to challenge and dismantle the school-to-prison pipeline. He's currently working on his dissertation proposal at NYU, focused on the impact security resource officers have on students of color and how school leaders make sense of their school's disciplinary policies. He's also interested in culturally relevant pedagogy, linguistic justice, single-sex education, and Black masculinity in K-12 school settings. He's the founder and host of the successful podcast, Race Through Education. Welcome to Madison.
Thank you. I'm so glad to be here.
Thank you for being here. Finally, we have Daniel Russell, also a PhD candidate, but almost finished, as he might mention coming up. He's been a veteran educator since 1994, serving as a teacher at both elementary and secondary schools. He's also served as the Dean of Culture and Climate for a K-6 school in Los Angeles, and currently he works for the Center for Culturally Responsive Teaching and Learning as the coordinator of research development, as well as a lead instructional coach. Daniel's in his final semester at USC's School of Education, where his dissertation is focused on the persistence of overrepresentation of Black students in exclusionary discipline, despite the implementation of what we know to be PBIS, positive behavioral interventions and supports framework. Welcome to Daniel.
Thank you, Nicole, for having me. Welcome, everybody.
Well, guys, thanks for being here. Thanks for taking part in this panel. I think we could start this conversation in a lot of different ways, in a lot of different places, but I think it might be good to talk about some of the skills and some of the underlying dispositions that you guys think are important to this work. So the first question I want to put towards the panel is, what are the mindsets and what are the skill sets that you think enable us to teach in culturally sustaining ways? And I'd love it if Mike could get us started here, maybe talking about some of your own research and this notion of cultural repertoires.
Yeah, fantastic. The question about mindsets and skill sets. I know when I was back at CSET, Nicole used that language. I think it's probably Shiraki Holly's language. And I've struggled with it because I think I focus mostly on this idea of mindset. So a lot of the work I do is really around what are the beliefs? What's the knowledge and beliefs that teachers bring to the classroom and how does that influence their practices in the classroom? And so my approach is mostly around how do we really unpack those beliefs, so those mindsets, to try to get at what teachers are, how teachers are understanding what's going on in their classrooms. So a lot of the work, again, I do is mostly around language and language ideologies. So the ideas, simple things like the narratives that teachers tell themselves about why kids should study English and grammar in schools. And there's a pretty clear narrative that teachers tell about, well, you know, students are going to need to have proper, good, standard English for job interviews. They're going to need it in order to, you know, get into good colleges. They're going to need it for standardized tests. And there's a whole set of these gatekeeping moments that we need standardized English for. And rarely do they question, well, why is that? Why do we need standardized English at a job interview? Who's the listener on the other end of that? And how are they interpreting the language that's coming along. So a lot of my work is really trying to add a critical lens to the stories that teachers tell about the purpose for what they're doing in school, and getting them to maybe tell some different stories, to create some counter narratives about how could we do language differently in classrooms. And I say all this, you know, language, I think, is just the most wonderful concrete instantiation of culture. So when we talk about things like culture more broadly, for me, it comes through in language. How people use language is often a window into larger cultural practices. And the way that we police language is a clear sign of how we police culture in schools. So if we can undo some of that work of policing language and forcing people to use particular standardized normative ways of using language, we can also get away from trying to standardize culture and promote normative ways of doing culture in schools. For me, a lot of it is just surfacing for teachers things that they just think of as common sense in terms of language, and getting them to critically interrogate those beliefs. And then once they've done that, it becomes a lot easier to say, okay, so what are we doing differently? We're not going to talk about correct English anymore in school, because we know that's not a thing. That doesn't exist. So we don't have to correct students' language. What we can do is talk about why they're using the language they're using, what the impact of that language is on particular audiences. We can talk about how they receive language. And so even when I'm working with white suburban students, I'm doing a lot of work with them and white suburban teachers on unpacking these language ideologies so that we're not reproducing people who hear language in the same way over time. So just trying to disrupt that. And again, for me, it's mostly about the mindset piece of it, the beliefs and the ideologies.
Right. I really like what you said about sort of unpacking and being really reflective on where you're coming from as an instructor, where you're coming from as a teacher, and where those narratives, right, ultimately come from. I'd really love to get Madison involved too on this question of language and culturally sustaining pedagogy. So would you add a little bit to what Mike's already told us?
Absolutely. I would love to say that, first of all, Mike Betts has definitely inspired some of my practices. So he's definitely the guru, the goat for all of that. So I'm very thankful for you, Mike Metz. And I want to kind of jump onto the boat of language and linguistic justice. And I know that I'm going to talk about this maybe a little bit later. But the first thing that I wanted to mention is that we have a lot of linguistic geniuses in our classrooms. The fact that we have different literacy practices, languages, acknowledging that Black language is a language is extremely important. It's not a dialect. It's not any of those things. So what I try to tell teachers when I'm using an asset-based approach is, first of all, you have to see what the students bring to the classroom. What are their linguistic practices that they're having in the classroom? How are they using those practices? I think we often forget that literacy is really about the word and the world and how we make sense of things. And we have to be able to communicate in different ways. So we don't understand how young people are communicating. We also are going to fall in line to the standardization of language, which, as we know, is rooted in whiteness and white supremacy. And we want to make sure that teachers are really unpacking that and understanding, how do I contribute to this? Because even Black folk, even brown folk like myself, sometimes we internalize whiteness. We internalize standard English, standard way of doing things. And we have to realize that all of those things were not designed for us to get with. And we have to question the foundation of how we value other languages over others. And thinking about that, all languages is what make America beautiful. It is the Amanda Gorman that we have, making sense of all of that and thinking about what we can do. And you can imagine how we just tell students, don't speak proper English or use academic language, which sometimes is coded in whiteness, depending on how it's used. So I think that we have to give students freedom to speak their own language, the right to their own language, and teachers need to check their biases and realize that even though they might have benefited from internalized whiteness and white supremacy, even as a Black educator, that we have to unpack that, dismantle that, and make sure that students are getting the justice that we know that they deserve in classrooms.
Absolutely. Daniel or Felicia, would you guys like to respond to?
When I was teaching, we did a lot of equity work in my school, and we did a lot of investigation of mindset, which was super important for me, like Nicole shared, as a white educator to unpack some things that I didn't realize were biases, to check my beliefs and to see where they were coming from, like Mike discussed. And we did a lot of years of that. And it was really great for me, but I kept kind of hitting a wall where I couldn't translate it to something different for my students. And so what I really appreciate about the combination of mindset and skill set is, yes, I need to examine my deficit thinking, and I need to look at where my beliefs come from, and I need to understand my cultural biases, my cultural norms, and understand where my students' cultural preferences may be different. But then I got to bring it to the pedagogy. I got to make the pedagogy different, because as Nicole said, if I keep doing the same thing, it just lives in my beliefs. And it's nice to believe it, but I got to change the experience for my students. And so that's where connecting the cultural behaviors to the instructional strategies and making sure that I create a balance in my classroom where I'm not privileging just the white Anglo-Saxon cultural behaviors, but I'm really making an intentional effort to validate and affirm those underserved cultural behaviors so all of my students feel that their culture is being honored and celebrated, and all of my students are having the opportunity to practice experiencing cultural behaviors that aren't theirs, that global dexterity, you know, that they're going to need in the world.
Felicia, I'm going to follow up just to quick, because you and I use this notion of cultural behaviors in Daniel as well in our classroom and in our instruction. Can you just quick give us an example of a cultural behavior that maybe is a vibrant and extraordinary opportunity to learn, but that's not valued by traditional school culture, and how, you know, how what does this look like? Because I think your point about it's great if you change your mind, but how are we changing our students' experiences? So could you just unpack that for a quick minute before we move over to Daniel?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you one that's near and dear to my heart, which is conversational patterns. And while I am white racially, I am Jewish culturally, and really my Jewish ethnic culture is very important to me. And I come from a culture of verbal overlap. So in my family, when we converse, it's respectful and it's actually honoring to jump in, right? To engage with people and to show that you are interested and that you're caring about what they're saying, you jump in, right? Mm-hmm. I lived in New York for a while, and there's plenty of cultures there that are cultures of verbal overlap. So it was very common there. Then I moved to Minnesota, where I think, you know, it's the turn-taking capital of the universe. And that is what is expected in school. So I had a student last year who did a independent study with me on cultural responsiveness. And he read Dr. Holly's book, and he worked with me on some training for students. Mm. And one thing he and I talked about a lot, and this was a biracial student who identified with Black culture, you know, he was a biracial student with a white mother and a Black father, and he identified heavily with Black culture. And he said he never understood why, when in his family, you know, it was all about, you know, the joy and the beauty of talking together, and it's kind of messy, but it's beautiful. And then he came to school and he was penalized for jumping in with enthusiasm when he was, you know, just sharing in communicating in a way that was beautiful for him and totally misunderstood by his teacher. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if that answers your question, but that, and so we as teachers can recognize verbal overlap is a valid communication. And in fact, for some of us, it's like a really beautiful communication norm that is connected with our family and our heritage. And how can we acknowledge that and use instructional practices that invite that actually encourage that with our students.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate that so much, just because as an Italian woman, verbal overlap was the way we showed love, right? And interestingly enough, all through my high school, verbal overlap was just the way we did it. But then I got to college and I went to a very, very, very white liberal arts, small liberal arts college, and was told in no uncertain terms how rude I was. And I was just excited to talk about this book that we had just read, right? So I appreciate that. Thank you. All right. So, Daniel, we're going to come over to you. And I know you've done a lot of work in the pedagogical realm, and certainly could speak to that at length. I'm wondering if you can connect this notion of cultural behaviors and culturally sustaining work in our schools to what you're learning about discipline. I think Madison's and Mike's point about like policing language, I hadn't heard it like that before, and it really was profound, because as you police the language, you also police the culture. And I had never really put those two things together. So I'm wondering if you can tell us a little bit about this idea of reforming disciplinary practices, or making a shift from what's typical in schools to something that really honors the humanity of our students.
Sure. I'm going to take a step back, because the mindset piece that our other panelists have spoken to really addresses this. And Felicia mentioned a word. She talked about the underserved, right? And in our work with culturally and linguistically responsive practices in teaching, that's a key word we use, because it speaks to the power dynamics in our school systems, right? Mm-hmm. There are students who have been historically underserved. We can look at decades and decades and decades of data, and we see who school has not been working for and who school does work for. And this is where the idea of cultural behaviors come in, because when we unpack that, we see that those students who come to school with behaviors that align to the white dominant culture norms of what is acceptable, whether it's through actions or language, and language meaning both the register you're using, the tone of voice, right, how loud, how expressive you are, whether you wait your turn or whether you jump in, all of those things have been what we consider as traditional, normal, acceptable, have been normed on those white middle class value systems, right? And for students who come aligned to that or assimilate to that, school works very well for them, right? Academically and behaviorally. For our students that we identify as underserved, it's because we're saying school is not serving them. It is not meeting their needs, because the practices, not only just the pedagogical practices, but even the way we look at data, the way we respond to disciplinary issues is not done in a culturally congruent way. So let's tie that to the persistence of racial disproportionality, right, and exclusionary discipline. What the research is showing us is that the majority, and I'm just going to take Black students, the majority of Black students who are removed from the classroom, and let's just start with office disciplinary referrals, are for subjective reasons, what are essentially considered minor behaviors, right? And these, in our work, we call them the three Ds: disrespect, defiance, and disruption, right? Mm-hmm. But these are subjectively judged. And what we know is that overwhelmingly, Black students are judged from a white paradigm, mm-hmm. and are being removed from the classroom for what are essentially cultural behaviors. As Felicia mentioned, I had a former student who changed schools and had never been to the office a day in his life. And at his other school, when the teacher asked a question, he spontaneously replied. Spontaneity is a cultural behavior. Verbal overlap is a cultural behavior. Oral expressiveness is a cultural behavior. And he responded in that way. And the teacher said, "You're rude. You're disrupting the classroom," and wrote him an office referral and sent him out. Mm-hmm. His mother called me the same day. Mm. Right. By the way, they messed with the wrong woman, because she was also a principal. But this is what we're talking about. So when we look at the data, we see these are the practices. This is what's happening. My most recent, which is being added to my chapter two right now, is I'm looking at, because specifically, we actually have lost focus on what's happening to Black girls in our school. Mm-hmm. So if anybody's familiar with Kimberly Crenshaw's work or Morris, you know, Push Out, right? Mm-hmm. What we're finding is white female standards of femininity are being imposed on Black girls. right? Mm-hmm. And because Black girls do not conform to these dominant culture notions, racialized notions of what femininity is supposed to look like, mm-hmm. They're being judged by it and being removed from the classroom. Mm-hmm. In fact, at rates much higher than Black boys, right? Mm-hmm. Black boys, it's 3 times as much as white males. For Black girls, it's up to 12 times as much as white girls mm-hmm. that they're being removed because they are exhibiting ethnic cultural behaviors that have been racialized, that have been marginalized and seen as negative.
Mm-hmm. And so, Daniel, when you work with a school that has instituted PBIS, for example, what's the shift that they have to make in that? Because PBIS, as I think you've taught me, was really tested on kind of white suburban kids mm-hmm. and normed around that. And when it's overlaid onto kids who are largely underserved by schools and predictably underserved, it becomes, I would imagine, kind of weaponized, almost like SEL can be weaponized mm-hmm. if it's not done in a culturally sustaining way. So how do you support schools in thinking about these things differently?
One question I'm going to borrow from the work of Paul Gorski. I ask him, are you interested in mitigation or transformation? Mm-hmm. Right. And so what we're finding is most people are just interested in mitigation. We just want to get our numbers down so we don't have the state on our back. Right. We're not talking mm-hmm. about real change. Right. Mm-hmm. And I'll ask, are you looking at systems change or are you just trying to look at how you can change students? Because if you're looking at, if you really want to be culturally responsive in your implementation of PBIS, you have to look at a systems level. It's not about changing students. It's not about changing parents. It's about changing systems and practices and policies that are negatively impacting students and asking, are you ready to do that? Because if you're not ready to do that, then we don't really have a conversation to go, because I'm not going to come in and support you on something that you really aren't ready committed to do that work, right? Are you ready to bring change the power dynamics in your district or school to bring in students, parents, and community members of historically underserved groups and make them fully included in the decision-making process,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
We're not talking about the usuals, and we're not talking about like, oh, here's a piece of paper, we already made decisions. Like, they have power at the table. Mm-hmm. And they're going to make decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that's asking that question. If you're not going to bring them in and accept them as stakeholders and be willing to give up your traditional power structures you have in place,
mm-hmm.
then anything that I would share would just be surface and not really result in any systemic change. We're not talking about transformation at this point. So
right.
That kind of sets it up right there.
I say a lot to teachers, do you want them to comply or do you want them to engage? Because there's a difference if we're demanding compliance versus creating opportunities for engagement. Mike's got a question that he's itching to ask, but yeah, I feel like at this point, I just want a quick pause, because in our work, this is the point where teachers are thinking, but it can't be a free for all. We don't want a discipline disaster, right? And at that, I just ask you to pause and really think where that's coming from, because if we think that this is a free for all, then we've got some work to do in our own hearts and minds, because we're not talking about that. And anybody who's been anywhere where there is a community of color and the expectations are high for kids, education is super valued for kids. And this idea that we could flip that and see it as, well, it will be a free for all if we're responsive. I just really want to make sure that it's clear that that's not what we're saying at all.
Nicole, I'll take that as a jumping off point, right? Thinking about wanting our kids to really engage instead of just comply, and wanting to recognize that having high standards, right, is not oppose or the opposite of engaging in practices that bring equity, right? So I do think that sometimes there tends to be this notion that equity and excellence can't coexist in the same space, or that they're somehow at odds with each other. So I do want to build on that idea. We're talking really about the ways that schools are underperforming and underserving many of our students. And a lot of times that gets framed as talking about low performing students, right? But I wanted to maybe turn to Felicia on this one, because I know that you teach a wide range of courses, but I know that part of that is teaching AP level courses, right? And we don't often talk about culturally relevant or culturally sustaining pedagogies in the realm of honors and advanced placement courses. And I was wondering if you had some words of wisdom for us on how we should think about that, how we should think about making those courses culturally sustaining, because a lot of people don't think that they have to be.
Yeah, totally. In fact, there was a colleague of mine, and it was really disheartening to hear this, but he said, oh yeah, I use that cultural responsiveness for my intermediate and my low level classes, but you know, I got to get to it in AP. And that's really disheartening, and that's not serving any kids, right? Because some of the things I found in implementing culturally responsive practices in AP classrooms is, first of all, we know that many of our students feel, even though Nicole said there's an open access policy for the College Board, I also work with the College Board, and that's a commitment, but we haven't prepared teachers to know how to create the environment that kids want to be in those classes, right? So even this morning, I was advising a group of my students, and they were talking about how when they go to AP classes, they still feel like they're one of the few, right? And why I think that is because we create a compliance culture more so in our AP classes, right? We expect you to come in and get to business. And we expect that if you're in an AP class, you're just there to get the job of school done, right? And some of my students of color who have been successful in my AP class, one of the things they've said is you create a sense of family or a sense of community, you know? And we call that cultural behavior immediacy. The idea that students should just come and do school like a job, you know, we do that at AP classes. We're like, okay, we got to get ready for the test. You turn to page, you know, 24, no time for any love, right? And what we're failing to recognize is all of our students, you know, that's a very intimidating environment for a lot of our students, even our students who are successful. So to create that sense of immediacy, that sense of relationship is really important for our students. The other thing that I think is just such a misunderstanding is the idea that culturally responsive pedagogy isn't rigorous. I think it is more rigorous because you're shifting the cognitive load to the student. The teacher is stepping back with culturally responsive pedagogy, and you know, Zaretta Hammond's work confirms this as well, and you're shifting that cognitive load to the students. And some of my AP students at first, they didn't really like it because they liked to sit quietly and take notes while their teachers blabbled on and on and on and on. But actually, it's more rigorous when you're using the culturally responsive practices. And if we look at Bloom's taxonomy, they're doing more of that evaluating, synthesizing, analyzing. And so I think it's just a complete misunderstanding. And I also think the last thing I'll say is that while it's necessary for our underserved students, it's also necessary for our students who have been traditionally successful in AP classrooms, because let's face it, the world is not, most jobs are not, you sit in your desk facing forward, meek and mild, and you don't talk to anybody and you fill out a worksheet. That's not the world, right? So we're not servicing any of our kids by creating that culture in our AP classrooms.
Thank you. That was great. That was powerful. I think that you're so right that the AP and honors classrooms have been set up in a lot of ways that almost preclude the possibility of culturally responsiveness, right? That sort of demand passivity from our students that doesn't really serve them well, that isn't going to serve them once they get out into the world, right? And that doesn't serve their success in classrooms. So thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm. Madison, I know that you also teach AP Lit and perhaps language as well as the other courses that you have in your English department. I'm wondering how can you speak to your work, particularly around sustaining language in such a traditional, what could be or what is often seen as a very traditional English language course? And then secondly, bridge us how this is looking for you and for our kids in the remote space, what you're maybe doing differently, what you're maybe doing more intentionally. And then after that, we'll go back to Felicia and have you take us through a couple of remote ideas. Let's start with Madison.
Perfect. So I always come in through, all of my teaching practice coaching through a language perspective. I think that that is extremely important. I think when we're thinking about culturally sustaining practices, it's not just the content. A lot of people like to swap in these very cool, very top YA novels, and those are all great, but it's what you do with it, because you're just not giving content and then just hoping that the content does all of the work. You have to do the things that promote equity. You have to do the things that promote use of different sorts of languages and linguistic practices in classrooms. So I never tell students in my classrooms, and I fought with my school about using the framing of academic language, because what is academic language, right? The second thing is policing students' languages in classrooms. Students should be able to talk the way they would like to talk as long as they are respecting each other. I also believe in the whole overlapping framing of learning, because that is how a lot of cultures communicate. It is not a bad thing to overlap in conversation. So I let that happen as well. I think a lot of times we're thinking of AP courses, we're thinking of structure, and we're thinking about how sometimes the system or the structure has given us a very narrow scope of how to do certain things. And we all know as teachers that that doesn't actually work when we're thinking about the culturally sustaining pedagogy. So we're hoping that the College Board will eventually catch up, but they have not. you know, but I think that what we have to really promote is when we're looking at certain texts in classrooms, right? If we're looking at Their Eyes Were Watching God, if we're looking at Toni Morrison, Beloved, whether you're teaching Black students, Latin students, or white students, I find that contrastive analysis does not work, because contrastive analysis is you're saying to students, your language is valuable, but not valuable enough for you to use it on an everyday practice. You only can use it when you're with your friends and family. But that's when students are thriving the most, when they are feeling loved, when they're feeling supported, when they feel like the classroom is family. So if you deny those things that they experience, what are you actually bringing into the classroom? What are you actually allowing that first? And second, we don't make white students do contrastive analysis. We don't make white students meet any sort of standards, because they are the standard. When we looked at No Child Left Behind, because white districts, white schools were the standard, they didn't get any sort of flaming like underserved schools in urban centers. It was always about how we have to catch up to the school on the hill. So we have to question those things. We have to think about these systems and structures. And I think I bring that into the classroom as well. I allow students to think about all of the structures and positionality of who they are, what they bring into the classroom, and thinking about texts as not only a way to understand the world, but how do you become a social justice advocate? You know, teaching is definitely very political, and people who say they don't want to bring politics into the classroom are not doing justice to students, especially Black and Brown students. What I'm doing in the classroom, I know that I'm going all the way around. What I'm doing in the classroom
that's good.
Is I am giving students more flexibility. I know that I teach AP Lang and AP Lit. So the question that I always ask my students right in the beginning is, how do we invite white authors into our classroom? And how do we make sure that they're not taking up too much space? And even I show them the exam, and we go through the exam and we say, like, look, they love Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, Toni Morrison, and a few others, and everything else is white. But we're going to do things a little bit different because it's about the skill set. It's about your learning and engaging, and you can't rush through content. You can't rush through the skills that they need. And someone brought up Hammond's work. You know, students need chunk information. They need time to learn. They need time to apply that. And I think the AP exam, the AP course doesn't set us up for that because it's go. You need to, you know, learn all of these things. And I think that that is a huge disservice to students that actually make it into AP Lit and Lang. I know that I said a lot of it was political, but, you know, I think to be political, you have to be able to take the heat with that. So I stand by my we want to change structures. And part of those structures is letting people who are making exams that this is not right by students.
Right. Right. And we 100% support that notion as well. I have a really hard time with this question of politics. Right. And when is it really just about the humanity of our kids and our teachers and honoring the full humans that they are? Madison, I'm going to follow up with a quick question before we go over to Felicia to talk to us about the remote space. You use the word respect, which I find is often like academic language used in a coded way. And a couple of weeks ago, I told a story about a girl and I got pushback on social media. It was fascinating. One of my students who I adored, and it was mutual, we adored each other. And she told me one day that she didn't like the dress I was wearing. She told me it wasn't cute. And I knew at that moment who this child is, and that kind of direct communication is love. She's telling me, I love you. That dress doesn't do you justice. You're much cuter than that, right? And I knew that because I knew her, and that's how my family speaks, so I got it. But the pushback I got on social media was how disrespectful that was. And when I said to her, are you telling me that because you love me? And she said, yes, if I loved you, I wouldn't tell, if I didn't love you, I wouldn't tell you that at all. So I'm wondering about how you navigate this word respect, because I agree with you completely. If there's no harm being done, then kids need to make sense of what they're learning in the language that they use most often. Where does this word respect come in for you with regard to language?
I think that students will often not feel disrespected in classrooms. I feel that a lot of classrooms, teachers feel disrespected because they don't understand the linguistic practices of Black and Brown languages and literacy practices that exist. I think there is a difference between cultures that are individualistic and collectivist, and how we are making sense of learning and knowing. So if you're in a collectivist, if you come from a collectivist community, you having conversations and working in a group and literally going back and forth, sometimes even yelling at each other just to get the language, to get the knowledge build up, is part of that culture. And I think that when I use the word respect, I'm really talking about how students are using the same linguistic violence, symbolic violence, anything that is really breaking down humanity. And I love you, Nicole, for saying that. I think we forget about the humanity of the students that we're teaching. I think that respect is anytime someone is breaking down humanity. And I think that that comes with your typical tropes, which is gender, race, orientation. I think there's a huge difference. And I've used that with teachers that I coach as well. Like, you have to understand the linguistic practices of the students that are in your classroom. And that means watching shows, going into the community, listening, just listen to students. You know what you can do? I tell a new teacher, come into the classroom, give a topic, just let them talk. And you're going to go around and you're going to take notes of the linguistic features and things that you've learned. And it was crazy because she came back to me. She's like, I know that I'm learning so much from my students because I allow them to just talk freely. They were saying whatever they wanted about a specific topic. And I think she put out several topics. And there was no policing of language body. Students were on the chairs, whatever. And I think that that is a good practice to just listen, write down, take your notes, be in the field, and understand these linguistic geniuses that we have in our classrooms.
I love it. I love it. I love that phrase, linguistic geniuses. Okay, Felicia, let's come back to you for one last question, just in the remote space. And then we're going to bring it back to Daniel and Dr. Metz to talk about some of the things that Dr. Hines is going to ask about. But I want to hear about this remote space.
Well, I don't think any of us planned for this, right? None of us chose or thought we'd be teaching through a computer screen. But many of us are finding ourselves in that situation. And when this happened last spring and we had to make that quick pivot, what we saw is, unfortunately, a lot of teachers, and really through no fault of their own, I mean, they were really, you know, put in a position that they didn't even know what they were doing, right? For the most part, had to build a whole new way of teaching with no preparation. But they became very traditional and they started talking at kids, right? And now kids can literally tune us out and turn us off, right? They can literally turn off their camera, go take a nap, you know? I mean, and so the imperative to keep culturally responsive teaching alive, even in a remote setting, you know, became very important to me this summer. And I worked on developing a workshop on online strategies, which I think will be important post-pandemic too, as many teachers are using technology. Of course, the main thing is it doesn't matter if you're teaching in a building or on a Zoom screen. The first thing is you've got to show that we call outrageous love or more love for the students who need it more, right? And you can have cool Kahoots and Quizlets and Pear Decks and all these great tools. But if you're not showing that love, especially during a pandemic, to the kids, you know, who are really struggling, it doesn't matter. So that principle stays the same. But what we got to recognize is our students need some of those behaviors we've talked about so far, that communalism, that sociocentrism. And this is so isolating for them. So what we worked on in our workshop is how can we create strategies, not because they're cool tech tools, but because they validate and affirm communalism. So how can we take Jamboard, which is a tool we feature, and how can we use it to give students a chance to work collectively and build knowledge communally, which is something that we really we're striving to do in the classroom? Or how can we use, you know, a Pear Deck to have them be sociocentric and have a chance to socialize with peers as they learn? So that's really been the feature of the thrust of the work we've been doing, is we can't let that go just because we're on a screen.
I think that we're moving towards the end of our time. We've got about 5 minutes left. And so I want to throw one last question out there and make sure that everyone gets a crack at it. You know, all of you work in some capacity with teacher candidates, with people who are in the classroom doing the work. Many of you are also teaching, so you have colleagues. And I think one of the things that happens a lot of times is that teachers say that they feel like having to learn culturally sustaining pedagogy is something extra or something additional, right? And they're so burnt out and they're so overburdened already. We know that teachers are asked to do so much, right? How do you respond to that? How do you get teachers to make culturally sustaining pedagogies something that's fundamental, right? Something that's not extra, that's not an additional thing, but really is something at the center of their teaching. I want to start with Mike and then move to Daniel, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic question. Right now at the University of Missouri, we're really working to integrate a critical consciousness framework into everything that we're doing in teacher education. And I think the kind of the starting point for all that work is getting students to question from day one, what's the purpose of schooling? And when we start reframing that really fundamental question of what's the purpose of doing this? So in English classrooms, what's the purpose of the school subject English? That if we can reframe that question, like it's not about getting good test scores. It's not about necessarily getting into college. We're going to look at what are the other things that this could be, developing a person, developing empathy, developing citizens. There's a lot of work that can happen that is changing this fundamental purpose, and then everything else starts to fall into line. So it's part of why I really do emphasize this idea of the ideologies, as a driving force for all this. It's about systemic change. If we continue to work in the system as it's always been, we'll continue to get the results we've always gotten, even if we use culturally responsive, culturally sustaining practices within a system that's inherently oppressive. We're going to still get the same results. We've got to shift the fundamental purpose of schooling. And once we do that, then all the things we do in our teacher education program start to line up, that we're not, it's no longer tangential. It's central to everything we do. So in an English classroom, it means we look at a different set of texts. We're not interested in, standardized grammar instruction, because standardized grammar instruction isn't the goal. It's not the end point. We're interested in expansive linguistic repertoires. And so if we want expansive linguistic repertoires with all kinds of communicative toolkits, then we're not just going to drill one kind of grammar. And so it changes what we do. In order to give students an expansive linguistic toolkit, we've got to teach differently. And therefore, it's central to how we do English education. It changes everything by changing that purpose.
Mike, thanks. I hear so much of what you're saying, and I hear so many echoes of what Daniel was saying in terms of aiming at transformation and not mitigation, and things that we had touched on a little bit earlier. Daniel, I want to know if you want to build on what Mike is saying here.
Sure. And I'm just going to give like a real practical strategy, because this is a question we get often when we're coaching teachers one-on-one. We get the, I don't have the time for this. My district has too many initiatives. Right. And so one of the things I just do is say, okay, I need to reframe this, culturally sustaining or culturally responsive, reframe it not as a what, but a how and a why. Right. Let's get away from seeing it as a what. That's first thing that's blocking you. Second is just a parts of speech thing. Let's use this as an adjective instead of a noun. Right. Mm-hmm. So put culturally responsive or culturally sustaining in front of something else. Language instruction, culturally responsive, language instruction, discipline, culturally responsive, so culturally sustaining discipline. So when I get the teachers I work with to reframe it that way, then they see it's the lens through which they're looking at everything, right? And so now it's not a thing. It's not an other. It becomes, everything becomes connected by this ideology, as Mike will say, right? This mindset and the way we see it.
Felicia, would you want to jump in?
Say something quickly. People talk about how budgets are moral documents. What you spend your money on is what you value. Well, time is a currency. Mm-hmm. So what you spend your time on is what you value. We all have to put in time. And for me, this is where I want to put my time.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. And we'll finish up with Madison. You've got the last word.
I think that what everybody said here is on point. It is excellent. Mm-hmm. I don't think I have anything to add other than we're trying to educate the whole child. Mm-hmm. We're trying to bring humanity back into the classroom. And I think that that is foundational to what we do as educators. Mm-hmm. How do we decenter ourselves and put them in the center?
So, Mike, takeaways for our day as we come to a close.
Oh man, there's
there's a lot to think about.
I keep going back to the notion of educating the whole child, to the notion of letting our students show up fully in the classroom. And to really fundamentally rethinking and reimagining education. I think that's what all of our panelists have been asking us to do, right? To start from the ground up, right? And reimagine what education can look like. And we've got the opportunity to do it right now. We're in a place where there's so much uncertainty, but also so much opportunity. And I think that that's what, you know, this series of conversations has really reinforced for me for the last 4 weeks. So this is just another building block in that. So.
Indeed, indeed. And also, I would just add some takeaways for me, very practical examples of how we interrogate our own culture and how it does or doesn't match the culture of school, and really think about the genius that we can make space for linguistically and culturally in our classrooms. Because as Madison mentioned earlier, we can't just let the content do the work. We actually need to create the spaces for that, for those geniuses to come through.
Thank you all for joining us. We cannot thank you enough for sharing your time and your genius with us as we all consider how to better serve our kids.
We hope you'll join us next week for episode 5 of Teaching to Meet the Moment, where we talk about synchronous and asynchronous learning. What does this even mean? How is it different from homework and classwork? And what decisions go into what should be synchronous learning and what should be asynchronous learning, particularly when we have our eye on questions of equity? We'll talk with 4 folks in the field that are making these decisions every day. We look forward to having you next week, and we'll see you then.